But I don't. I really don't have any regrets. I really don't. I've lived exactly how I've wanted to. I've tried my hardest every single time. I didn't win the matches that maybe I should have always won. But I really gave it my all. So that for me is enough.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Surf. I'm James.
I'm Jonathan.
And we're back by popular demand on our second viewing of Beyoncé's Homecoming already.
That, well, 1.36. We kind of skipped through the important parts time. Where are we at? We're at episode 155. The clay swing is well and truly underway. Monte Carlo is in the rear view. The big women's only clay event in Stuttgart is happening as we speak, and the men are in Barcelona.
A lot of the tennis world has been bored by clay tennis for the past few years, for the past decade, really. Rafa wins Monte Carlo, Barcelona, as such a matter of course, that it is huge news when he doesn't. Not even make the final, but when he doesn't win the title. And this week, Monte Carlo saw a totally different look than it has in the past 13, 14 years. Fabio Fognini won, beating Dusan Lajovic in the final, in Lajovic's first career final on the ATP level, Fabio's first Masters Series title, as you know, the princes of clay losing early, Zverev and Thiem, and Zverev losing early again in Barcelona. If you want intrigue and a little diversity in the clay court swing, you got it.
There's a lot to parse through with what you just talked about. First, for me, it was not shocking that Rafa lost in Monte Carlo. I think it was shocking that, and it wasn't even, I guess, shocking that he lost to Fognini, but it was kind of shocking the scoreline being down 6-4, 5-love, before eventually losing 6-4, 6-2. And I say that because Rafa is coming off of the injury at Indian Wells. He had the injury, well, it seemed like he was not at his best to us in that final in Australia. Like, you just never know when that knee stuff is going to flare up, right? So he's coming back again from this situation. And in his very first match, he just dispatches Bautista Agut in no time. And he's looking pretty good throughout the tournament. He struggled a bit in the quarterfinal in the first set, going to a tiebreak. And then the semifinal happens where he really isn't able to muster anything against Fognini. Mm. So you got many different looks from Rafa this week. The big takeaway for Rafa and his fans, I suppose, after this match, in spite of the loss and the lopsided nature of it, was that Rafa still appears to be healthy. And he was fairly happy with his level, saying he's around 70% and he's going to keep building on it. If not next week in Barcelona, if not in Rome, then definitely at Roland Garros. He has confidence that he will get to where he needs to be.
Right. And he reminded us that just because he is not injured doesn't mean that he's not playing with pain. He still is not feeling 100%. The match against Fabio was just really bad. Like, there's no getting around it. He didn't play well. The forehand wasn't there at all.
He said it was the worst match he'd played in Monte Carlo in 14 years. It's he said on clay. I thought that might have been it. But if not on clay, definitely at Monte Carlo. That's still a long time to say that this is the worst that you've played.
Yes, it may have been a little dramatic, perhaps. But it was a disappointing loss. I get the sense that Rafa doesn't like Fognini very much. And he has struggled against him in the past. He had a 5-set loss at the U.S. Open, I think in 2015.
Well, we know where we were because we left that match at the U.S. Open with Rafa up 2 sets to love, went and recorded an episode of this podcast, and when we were done...
Oh, right, right.
...looked up to see Rafa about to lose in the 5th set. So we remember that match.
Listen, this is not to take away from Fabio's talent, which is supreme when he's motivated. He can beat pretty much anyone. He's beaten Rafa 3 times on clay, one of the only people to ever do that. Thiem and Djokovic are included in that list.
I don't know if I would say supreme. He's very talented. Mm.
Fabio taking the ball early on clay was making Rafa look slow, which is not something you see very often.
You mentioned the Princes of Clay losing early in Monte Carlo. You talked about Zverev, you talked about Thiem. I would also add Diego Schwartzman to that list. Somebody who is very accomplished on clay, but who's been struggling in 2019.
Yes, struggling in several ways. He admitted that he kind of forgot to sign up for Barcelona, requested a main draw wild card, was rebuffed, and qualified for Barcelona as a top 20 player.
Only to then have to play Dominic Thiem, his bestie, and lose today.
Which is unfair to, well, unfair to Dominic. He's not the one who forgot to sign up.
This is your prototypical she got what she deserved situation.
No, I mean, it's not that bad of an offense. We like Diego, but it was just kind of funny.
It's very amateur. Yes. I mean, we get how it can happen, but you got to have people in your team to make sure that this doesn't happen. When I mean, you're sacrificing a lot of money at the very least, like a good like 20 grand by not getting an easy first round, winning a couple rounds. Like that's madness.
Alexander Zverev, we talked last week and I called it a mini slump. The mini slump has continued into Barcelona, losing to Nicolas Jarry in a third set tiebreak. He was down 3-love in the third set, evened it, lost serve again, got it to a tiebreak. I think it was like 7-5 in the tiebreak. But it's not a great loss, obviously. I don't think it's all doom and gloom. He said today that he feels like he's in a hole and he doesn't know how to get out of it, which I'm sure every player goes through. He's young. Let's not overreact.
I see you are still on the charitable train when it comes to Zverev. You pretty much lambasted me last time for going off and being not very charitable toward him.
Oh.
Previously, last week, he lost to the eventual finalist, Dusan Lajovic.
Yes.
Which, in retrospect, is not that bad of a loss, I guess. You know, it's always a better look for you when you lose to somebody who goes on to do big things.
Mm-hmm.
But then he gets to Barcelona, like you said, and he's out again early.
Who knows? Jarry might make the final or win Barcelona. That remains to be seen.
He might be the Venus Williams of this men's season, where she loses to players who go on to do big things.
Yeah. I'm just saying, why kick someone when he's down?
This is an entirely different look for you. The defender of Alexander Zverev.
No, not of Alexander Zverev, just the defender of people who are currently struggling. Mm. How about that? It's the Easter season.
We talked about a little bit of a preview segment we did of the men's clay court season that we were primed to have these princes take another step.
Mm.
And thus far, still early going, one tournament in 2 days, it hasn't happened.
Right.
To say the least. But we've gotten other things, like you said. We've gotten Daniil Medvedev having a big week, losing eventually in the semifinals, but he took out Djokovic, which is a huge win for him.
He did. He beat Djokovic in 3 sets in the quarterfinals. He, like Alexander, lost to Dusan Lajovic in the semifinals. Medvedev, this was after beating Stefanos Tsitsipas for the 4th time in a row now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call this matchup? Is this like Nemesis Cup?
Nemesis? It's the shut your fuck up cup.
Oh, I like it.
And Daniil is now 4-0 in the shut your fuck up cup.
He is. I think it's safe to say that he is firmly planted in Stefanos' head.
Stefanos will be out here vlogging and seeing Medvedev like lurking in the bushes. He'll be haunting his dreams at this point. Shall we touch on Fognini a little bit? I got a lot of pushback this past week for bringing up Fognini's past.
Mm. I have to say, I'm surprised that you went there, because I knew what the pushback would be. Because not only at this point, when a player gets success like this, you're going to get pushback from the normal trolls, but you're also going to get pushback from people who are like, listen, he just had a big achievement. Can't you just let it go?
Mm. See, I thought I was very clear in my wording that, what was it? What was my tweet?
You tell me.
I said, a preemptive strike ahead of today's Monte Carlo final. This was after Fognini had beaten Rafa and he was, at that point, likely to win his first Masters 1000s title. A preemptive strike ahead of today's Monte Carlo final. Should he win and the narratives get out of hand? A reminder that Fabio Fognini was thrown out of the 2017 US Open for calling chair umpire Luis Engzel a whore and a cocksucker.
Pardon our language.
Yes. Of course, those words were spoken in Italian at the time and translated.
We covered this at the time. I sort of forgot that there was an apology, so I have to make that clear. He did apologize publicly and said that he also apologized to the chair privately.
Yep, whatever. See, I didn't feel like making this a thread as a like a thread to thwart the pushback, you know?
Yeah.
Because yes, he apologized, but he also then immediately took to Instagram and then wrote
made
peanuts
light
and used the peanut emoji to make light of the fine. So and we talked about this on the show. This is Fabio's MO. Nothing is serious.
Right.
And for somebody to come to me and say, well, he apologized. Like, folks, even Fabio Fognini has PR people working for him.
Right.
And that is the base level of their job. When faced with at your place of employment, you tell your coworker that they're a whore or a cocksucker. I'm not going to censor myself. That's serious stuff. And so for
and no matter what sort of context that exists in the Italian language, first of all.
Or the fact that this is commonplace in Europe.
I can't imagine in what context that would be acceptable to do at work.
And this is right? West. This is Western bias.
Right.
You know, we're just so, so uptight over here.
And to be clear, I am a pretty okay Italian speaker, but I did not grow up there, and I don't understand the full cultural context of the, how those words are used.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a Philistine either.
And so... For Fabio Fognini to have said those things in his place of work, directed at a woman in a position that is a position of scarcity for women in men's tennis, a woman calling a men's match, right? There's all that. Let's talk about context. That is context. This is a woman trying to make her way in a man's world, not just in a man's world, but in a man's world within a man's world. And to have Fabio Fognini degrade her like that on one of the game's biggest stages, a PR apology doesn't do anything for me. And so what I was pushing back against, this preemptive strike I spoke about, was this want of sports writers to then, they have to write something. They don't have Rafa to talk about. They don't have what, El Duodecimo or something. I don't quite recall what it would be, the 12th, right? We had El Decimo and then La Undecima. It's out of hand with Rafa. All this winning that is that narrative is not there. Your easy fileable story, and so you're left with Fognini and Lajovic in this final. What are you going to write about? And so you could see the mercurial Fognini blossoming and maturing and whatever, segueing into good for the game. And for me, I didn't think that that was a tenable narrative to have unmitigated. When we've seen not just what he did at the US Open, but his years worth of track record and his also slap in the face peanuts emoji undercutting of his apology at the US Open. That's all that was about. And I'm frankly just, I'm not in a place in my life where I can give benefits of the doubt to these ill-behaving men. I'm just not. So that's where I'm at. I chose not to respond on Twitter. I've responded here. Because guess what? I got a platform that we've worked hard to maintain over the last few years. And it takes time and it takes work and it takes effort, and not everybody has that.
And we do it for free, by the way. Yes. Just a point of information.
That was another thing that we got clapped back on this week.
I said, wow, you ask for money you're blocking people? Like,
aren't you the folks who ask for money?
First of all, call me out for blocking you, definitely. Like, that's totally fair. I'm willing to engage with that. But just get your facts right. Yeah, I mean, subtract all the personal things about Fabio. His game is very attractive to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did this week was pretty amazing. It was pretty cool. And I like Italian tennis. More so the women's side. You know, to see Flavia and Francesca in the box there, reunited. It's cool to see.
You're a fan of Vinciana Rani.
Excuse me? I said Flavia e Francesca. I did not say Roberta.
It seems like you have...
Fettuccine or tortellini.
It sounds like you're a fan of a fraction of Italian tennis.
That's true. talk to me in 1977, it probably would have been all.
Let's be clear here as well. Part of this is folks are thirsting over Fabio. We've seen it time and again from certain factions of tennis Twitter and tennis fandom, where folks are willing to overlook a whole bunch of stuff because they stir something in them.
Right. Okay, enough about ATP. I'm annoyed with them in general, and I don't want to give too much time to the ATP because they don't deserve it.
Oh, so just the entire second half of this episode with the Gimelstomp
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. That's got enough. To come. We've got enough. The women were in Fed Cup this week.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't any women's tournaments. We had Fed Cup all over the world. World Group qualifying. The semifinals of the World Group went on.
Can we just talk about the Australia-Belarus matchup? Because that is what occupied my attention this weekend.
That is crackers. That is a great matchup. Belarus was a finalist a few years ago, losing to the United States. Remember when Coco Vandeweghe kind of led the team to Fed Cup glory? And that was also kind of the coming out party of Sabalenka and Sasnovich. Vika is back.
Vika is back. She partnered with Sabalenka. And on the Australian side, you had the young guard with the old guard. The matriarch of this generation of Australian women's tennis. Grand Slam winner, multiple times over in singles and doubles, Sam Stosur. An all-around just lovely person.
Just a chill, chill gal.
Joined by her protege in that regard. Ash Barty.
Ash Barty, now a Grand Slam winner herself. After many tries, many runner-up finishes with Casey Dell'Acqua in Grand Slam finals.
Ash Barty is 6-0 in Fed Cup play this year. In the previous round of Fed Cup in February, Ash went 3-0, winning both singles and then the doubles tie. And then this time around, she won both singles and the doubles as well, the clinching doubles with Stosur to make the Fed Cup final. And let's not underestimate the work that Barty put in to beat both Azarenka, which she did easily, and then Sabalenka.
So rewinding for a second, Nick McCarville tells us that going 6-0 in the first two rounds of Fed Cup has never happened before. Ash is the first one to do that. But back to her singles wins over Vika, as you said, pretty easily. I think Ash and Sabalenka, I've said it before, are this burgeoning rivalry. I'm so looking forward to what they do in the future. They're currently 2-2. Ash has lost to her in Zhuhai, but beat her in Australia. Like, they've played on big stages already. And I'm just excited to watch this contrast, because I think it brings out a lot in Barty's game.
I'm excited in the building of the Barty mojo, because so many times we see after a player has a big win in their individual career, which Barty did in Miami, winning her first Premier Mandatory title, she then goes and plays Fed Cup and has these big wins. You don't get to warm up and ease into these matches. You have to hit the ground running. And when you're already down love one because Stosur has lost to Sabalenka, it was an incredible match, a long match. It was power tennis to the max. Sam had her chances, but Ash then has the weight of this tie on her shoulders right away. And she's able to get the job done and not have this respite from the demands of her tennis career.
Right.
There's no vacation time. She's right back at it.
And Australia, as you know, is this huge sporting nation. In Fed Cup, there's going to be a lot of national attention on the women in the semifinals. I don't know how huge the attention is in Australia, but I imagine it's decent. Sure as hell a lot bigger than the US and Canada.
Apparently it's not as important as keeping up with Stefanos Tsitsipas's Twitter account for Nick Kyrgios.
Yeah.
Because so many of the Aussie bros have zilch to say about this momentous occasion for Australian women's tennis, right? This is a big deal. You just set that context of just how sport crazy Australia is, right? Like, this is not one of those instances where women's sport is relegated in most situations, especially in North America, right?
Right. And you also have really successful players on the Australian women's team.
These are women who are engaged, who want it, who are taking this seriously. And the viewing public is taking it seriously. But yet, the Aussie men. Save for John Millman, he's the only one. We saw a tweet from him in support of it. I just don't know how this misses your...
No, I mean...
How does this miss your various timelines?
Maybe he DM'd them individually. We don't know. Man. Nick's social media is devoted purely to trolling.
That's and the it. Boston Celtics.
Oh, okay, sure.
To be clear, trolling Stefanos Tsitsipas...
And now, Ben Rothenberg.
And Ben Rothenberg. And now lusting, presumably, after Amanda Nisimova.
We're not,
do what you will
not
with that.
Even going there.
Do what you will with that. And also the Boston Celtics, basketball.
Yeah. There are bigger problems in the world, which is what Nick said today. I don't know what they are. Like, he didn't give any examples. But in the other semifinal, France took out Romania, which I feel has to be seen as a huge upset. They had Simona Halep there, Monica Niculescu playing doubles with Simona. And this was an absolute heartbreaker for the whole Romanian team, and especially Simona Halep, who said she was pretty depressed for like the next couple days, pulled out of Stuttgart, injured, said that she had really given her all in Fed Cup, she wanted it so badly, and man, it's rough. Like, losing sucks. But France turned it out.
Listen, I disagree with you.
About?
That this was a huge upset, because France, on the women's side, has shown that they've got the pedigree. And no matter how much Kiki Mladenovic has struggled in singles, she's still very game when it comes to these situations.
She is a boss doubles player.
And added to that, Caroline Garcia is a boss. She is Mladenovic's boss when it comes to playing in Fed Cup.
They're back together in doubles, which is another huge story for tennis Twitter.
They are, but my point is, Garcia can beat anybody in this setting.
Okay, okay. Is that why they were so mad at her a few years ago when she didn't want to play?
Was I on the ground? Was I covering? Was I the beat reporter?
I'm happy that whatever drama was floating around the French Fed Cup team has dissipated.
I'm glad you didn't say disappeared, because I don't believe for a second it's disappeared.
No, but it seems I prefer to watch them getting along.
Yes,
absolutely. More than
because
more
they're
than
an
fighting.
Incredible doubles team.
Right, but the whole team in general. So Garcia had a really good weekend. She lost to Halep in a heartbreaker, in a really tight match. She beat Buzărnescu, and then she and Kiki won the deciding match against Halep Niculescu.
This is where it becomes incredibly difficult to go 6-0 in your first two ties. Because even if you win those two singles matches like Simona did, you still have to win the third rubber to win the tie. So it's not just all about you. You have to contribute a lot to the doubles as well. And maybe why Ash is 6-0 is because her doubles expertise is... Well, her credentials are just... Who parallels them?
Right. Well, currently no one. Because she's the only player on the men and women's side who's currently ranked within the top 20 in singles and doubles. Great Britain versus Kazakhstan. I feel like lately, wherever Great Britain goes, you know there's going to be some drama going on. Putintseva.
Are you throwing shade at Miss Jokanta right now?
No. Well, we'll get there. But so Britain defeated Kazakhstan 3-1. It was not easy. It was not always pretty.
And this is the first time they're back in the world group in decades.
Yeah. So this was a world group playoff. This is basically qualifies Great Britain for World Group 2, which that could change based on the changes coming for the Fed Cup. They might just be in regular old world group next year. We don't know what it's going to look like in 2020. But officially, this is World Group 2. Kazakhstan brought Zarina Diaz and the queen herself, Yulia Putintseva, which you have to admire this woman's competitive grit on the court, but also like the audacity, like just the way that she carries herself after a match is wild.
Her fucked upness?
It's not always pretty. I said it was not always pretty.
Okay.
But the celebrations, I feel like in Fed Cup there's way more leeway, right? You wouldn't do this at Wimbledon, but her celebration after
you
winning.
You wouldn't, but she would.
Well, but like flexing her bicep and then kissing it, this is what, like the crowd goes absolutely mad for this stuff. Kazakhstan's fans, who were small in number, but huge in volume, brought a small band, including a trombonist. to feel as new, the trombone. Apparently he was playing Beethoven's Fifth. People were very upset. The Brits were not loud enough to drown out the trombone.
That's on them.
I know. And so I feel lately that wherever like Great Britain goes in Fed Cup, they are aggrieved by something. And this is not meant to be a serious attack. Like, this is tongue-in-cheek, but are they not always bothered? Like, deeply bothered by something?
There was this whole business with Nastasi in Romania, right? That was Great Britain.
Oh, yes. And you can't really blame the British team for that.
No, like, what you're saying is that it's happenstance. It just happens to follow them, the drama.
Well, yes. However, they also know that certain players on the British team are an easy target.
Who is thin-skinned?
Laura Robson herself said on BT Sport about Konta, anything can set her off.
Really?
That's a direct quote.
Really?
And this is her countrywoman and probably friend. She knows that things get under Konta's skin. And I'm sure other players know that. The captains of other countries' teams know that. And it did. It really did on that first day. Now, Konta did come back from 1-4 down in the third set versus Putintseva to win, what was it? Her 11th straight singles match in Fed Cup. Like, that's wild.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot of winning.
That was actually not her first match. That was her second singles match. She played Zarina Diaz on the first day, and that was the day of the trombones and the drums, and she was very upset about it. She's annoyed. She managed to win that match, but that's what prompted Laura Robson to say that. That, like, things get under her skin and she shows it. Katie Bolter, her teammate, tweeted that night, "Does anyone know where in East London we can get musical instruments on short notice?" And lo and behold, the British fans show up with drums on day two. Crisis averted.
Elsewhere, the United States of America, home to Justin Gimelstob, they defeated Switzerland 3-2.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. brought Madison, Sloan, Sophia Kennan. Madison lost her singles match pretty badly, which, you know, she just won Charleston, it's fine. Sloan notched two singles wins this week, and Kennan won her first Fed Cup match after three losses. So the USA again stays in World Group. A little note about, like, what's coming for Fed Cup over the next year. It's a bit hazy right now. But as it stands, the ITF is trying to put together this week-long final in 2020 with 12 teams. So that's why I said earlier, if this 12-team final happens, Great Britain will be in World Group regardless. Like, they won't be in World Group 2. It'll just be one World Group. Currently, there are two World Groups, 1 and 2, made up of 8 teams each. The ITF has doubled the prize money for the World Group this year. And Gerard Piquet, you remember him? Of Cosmos Group that revolutionized the Davis Cup, did say in an interview...
I don't think the air quotes translated to the listeners when you said revolutionized.
I mean, a revolution doesn't have to be a good thing. Mm-hmm. But he did say in an interview that Fed Cup and Davis Cup might, in the near future, become a combined event. So looking at, you know, a lot of fans of Fed Cup are resistant to this. Navratilova said that Fed Cup was an afterthought, that the ITF was just like, whatever, whatever. Let them do what they want. We don't know what the future holds for Fed Cup. But for now, they're trying to plan this 12-team week-long finals. I think in the context of Fed Cup, like a lot of people, home and away ties are a huge draw. And that's going to be intrigue and drama that's missing from Davis Cup. And possibly Fed Cup. Like we saw this weekend, the sort of aura that can bring to the event. That's not always good, but it certainly is exciting.
It can devolve into a whole mess of nastiness.
Sure, which happened in Romania with Great Britain. But it's certainly a unique event that is at the risk of being, I would say, diluted.
And let's see how this Davis Cup thing plays out before we make any irrevocable changes to Fed Cup.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, actually.
Two bits of etc. news before we get into the Gimelstob news that just broke today. Kevin Anderson has withdrawn from the entire clay court swing. A total of four tournaments, including Roland Garros, he will not be playing because he consulted with his doctors and his team, and they felt it would be best for the health of his career going forward long term if he rehabbed his elbow that he's been struggling with.
Mm. It's funny you say long term. Kevin Anderson is already in his 30s.
Yeah.
But this is where we are in men's tennis, right? Like, he's no spring chicken.
In tennis, period.
Tennis, period. Mm-hmm.
We got little seedlings, little indications that this could be the case. But now we have official confirmation that Sasha Bajin and Kristina Mladenovic are a professional pair. I say professional because mm-hmm. Kiki's still a love pair with Dominic Thiem.
Right. I guess. I haven't been checking up on the Twitter and Instagram comments lately, so I assume.
No, they definitely are. I think the last thing I saw was she called him like the sexiest man in the world.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. When Rafa is right there.
Listen.
Sasha Bajin is kind of family friends with the Mladenovicis. Apparently they go way back. We weren't sure if this was an informal kind of friendly relationship, but now it is official. I mean, Sasha can do great things with players, as we've seen, so I'll be curious to see where Kiki goes from here.
Kiki was a top 10 player.
Yeah.
Right? She did make the top 10.
She did, yeah.
She had a great year 2 years ago when she was popping off, saying all kinds of shit against Sharapova and speaking her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the subsequent year, having to defend all those points, it went south. She is somebody of pedigree. She's shown. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a fluke. And maybe Sasha can help ground her.
Yeah.
And refocus her game.
I'm combined. They speak like 34 languages. They'll probably be communicating in Swahili, like Punjabi. Who knows?
Oh my God. You are too much.
Too much.
We have arrived at the meat and potatoes segment of this episode.
Well, that remains to be seen. The news that everyone is talking about, there has been a decision in the Justin Gimelstob case. He was in court Monday. The court heard victim impact statements from the victim, Randall Kaplan, heard from his wife, Madison Kaplan, and Justin entered a plea of no contest
to felony assault, which was then pleaded down to a misdemeanor. So Justin serves no jail time. He gets 60 days community service, as well as 3 years probation.
And 1 year of anger management.
It's going to take a lot more than that.
So my first question was, what is no contest? I've heard that before. I didn't have a clear understanding what that meant legally. It is neither admitting guilt nor contesting the charges that have been laid against you. But what you're doing is you're allowing the court to punish you at its will. You're not saying that I am guilty, but essentially its outcome is the same as a guilty plea. Now, different jurisdictions handle no contest differently. In California, no contest pleas can be used as an admission of guilt in other legal proceedings, because a lot of people are curious about what are the implications for a civil case coming mm-hmm. from this. Both parties have said that they will be filing civil cases. Justin's no contest plea does open him up to that court treating it as guilt and as an admission of guilt, because burden of proof in a civil court is generally much lower than a criminal court. In some cases, no contest is not an admission of guilt. And in California, misdemeanor cases, no contest cannot be used as an admission of guilt. But this was a felony case, even though the charge was negotiated down to a misdemeanor, ultimately. So surely civil cases are coming. He was also ordered restitution for Randall Kaplan, the victim. We don't know what that looks like yet. There's going to be another hearing later in the year.
This news was broken by Josh Boswell of the Daily Telegraph. Within that, you'll get to read some of the victim statements, but also go to Ben Rothenberg's Twitter account. He has them listed in full as well there.
Right.
And some of the stuff is absolutely harrowing.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, like, the victim statement, they can say whatever they want. They can provide hearsay. Randall Kaplan even relayed a story that he had heard about that incident at a paddleball tournament a few years ago. So you know, there's a little bit more leeway in victim impact statements, but if the bulk of what is said in that statement is true, it is a really difficult read. And I don't know how you can, like, look through that and just be like, well, he's good for me, so that's fine.
And what we know now is that there is video of this assault.
Yes.
That was shown privately in the judge's chambers, but not in open court. And that video is the smoking gun, really. It's the bit of evidence that could really sway this entirely against Gimelstob going forward.
Right, if it were ever publicized.
Because it's unclear at this point still whether the tennis establishment, the organizations with which he's still involved, be they Tennis Channel or the ATP Players Council, if those entities are going to look at this and see it as enough to distance themselves from him. Because the tea leaves say otherwise.
Yes. The Tennis Channel released a statement today, which I think is pretty clear that they don't feel any further action needs to be taken.
Quote, "We are sure that Justin is pleased that this matter has been resolved. Since he took his leave of absence from Tennis Channel in November 2018, we have been waiting for the legal system to run its course. Now that this is behind him, we will have internal meetings among our executives and meetings with Justin to discuss his future with Tennis Channel." And that's via Simon Briggs.
Notice how that statement is positioned.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's almost from Gimelstob's perspective, where we imagine that he is pleased with the conclusion of this case. This is, I mean, in the world of corporate statements, this truly shocked me.
This is like the White House saying, "We're having a great day," when the Mueller report comes out, right? How do you look at this right. and interpret it as it being pleasing?
But also, if you are a Tennis Channel, and this is something that is potentially embarrassing for you as an organization, you're taking up for Gimelstob. Like, your position is, well, we think our buddy Justin will be pleased. Like, but nobody asked. Like, nobody asked about that. You know, it was just such a strange way to start this statement. And to me, of course, we shall see, but it makes it quite clear that they're not taking, like, a very firm stance on this. I think that he will probably have to sit out for a little while, just so it doesn't look too bad. But I think he'll be welcomed back with open arms. I think overall it's less clear where the ATP stands in all of this, because they've chosen to put the onus on the Players Council to kind of deal with this. The way that they're structured, the Players Council can vote representatives in to the ATP board. They can also vote them out. So if the Players Council decides to show no confidence in Gimelstob, for example, I think the ATP is happy enough to take a hands-off approach. Mm-hmm. They would like the Players Council to just deal with this so they don't have to wade into it.
That much is clear from their statement,
mm-hmm.
which says Justin Gimelstob holds an elected position as one of the three player representatives on the ATP Board of Directors. And under our organization's bylaws, his position is therefore a matter of review for the ATP Player Council and or the ATP Board. The decision was taken to let the judicial process run its course before any judgment was made on his future. So with that process complete, this is now a subject for review by the board and or the Players Council. Listen, that's as
the
clear
board
as day.
And or? But what is that?
But
that part is murky to me.
Sure, but it's clear as day that they're saying, we are not touching this.
Right.
And any backlash you want to give us, give them. That's what they're saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like they've washed their hands of it. They're Pontius Pilate, and the Players Council can deal with all the dirty work.
Now, keeping with
the Easter theme, you know?
Now it's a time to watch the various parties involved and how they position themselves. We heard from Vashik Pospisil, who was quoted by Canadian tennis blogger Stephanie Miles, as saying that Justin is amazing at his job. They'd be happy to have him again, fighting for the players' rights on the ATP board, essentially.
Yeah.
He's been going through a lot of stuff in his personal life, but given the choice to have him, he'd be happy to have him.
He declined to comment on the case about what was going on, but was saying fairly clearly that if the vote came up again, he would vote yes because he feels that Gimelstob represents his interests.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask, like, at what point does one's self-interest outweigh the health of an organization in general? And can you go home and go to bed and think that I have integrity because what I voted for was the right thing to do?
The ATP has already separated themselves from the Players' Council. So that business of, does the ATP have integrity with respect to having Justin Gimelstob still mm-hmm. around? They've washed their hands of that.
Well, the ATP certainly doesn't.
We know right. that.
Like, neutrality in this situation is saying, well, we don't really give a fuck, so you all get your hands dirty and deal with it.
But what I'm saying is, folks are now positioning themselves. Tennis Channel, mm-hmm. ATP, the Players' Council, if we take Vasek as a spokesperson for them at this point, that's the only person we've heard from since this has happened. Everybody's positioning themselves for a post-verdict life.
Yeah.
Right? And where does Gimelstob fit into this? And we know now how he sees himself fitting into this. Because we've always, from this story broke, we were always on the side of the fence where, let's see how this play out or whatever, but the end result cannot be to still have him as in mind as ATP CEO to replace Chris Kermode. Right. And it's clear.
Because, like, regardless of what you think about the case itself, why would any organization worth its salt keep this kind of mess around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if you don't care, like, take away the judgment aspect. If you're a capitalist, are you looking at this situation and saying, like, oh yeah, that's exactly how I want my corporation to be run? No. Like, it's bad PR.
Gimelstob is not a good tennis commentator. We keep hearing about how much research and homework he does, but anybody who listens to his commentary can discern otherwise.
Why are you getting into that?
I'm just saying, because it undercuts this idea that he's essential to Tennis okay. Channel's product. He is not. And we are not essential to the tennis podcasting community. We know from doing this for 4 years now that we struggle to keep it fresh, to have ideas that are new, to not regurgitate rehashed stuff. Mm. Like, that is part of the trouble of being a tennis commentator, right? Like, it's a difficulty. But, and I sympathize with a lot of tennis commentators now who don't necessarily do a good job, because it's not easy. Honestly, it's not. And it's not easy for us to keep it fresh as
okay,
well.
Okay, this is very off topic. I think the gist is that no one is irreplaceable.
That's what I'm saying.
Everyone can be replaced. We can, you know, really the only people who you cannot replace are
the players.
Legends of the, well, players, and also, like, legends of the game who aren't even always the best commentators, but provide a perspective that nobody else does. Martina and Chrissy, right?
And he is not like, that either.
Right. So I have no interest in talking about his commentating skills. I do not subscribe to Tennis Channel. I will not in the future. It doesn't matter to me, personally.
That's easy for you to say because you don't even have that option in Canada.
Yeah, but we could. If you know a guy. Who knows a guy?
Okay, but we now know, as of this recording, Justin Gimelstob has started to emerge.
Actually, this happened while we were recording. He has tweeted a link from a New York Times piece by Cindy Schmerler, mm-hmm. who's been writing about tennis for like 1,000 years.
Yes.
The official New York Times article about what happened yesterday.
And the first thing that caught your eyes, one of the first few paragraphs, you're like, this isn't new.
It's like, wait a second. Some of this sounds like Christopher Clary's puff piece, probably 4 years ago. It was way back, like when we were a young podcast, about the busiest man in tennis.
Yes.
Remember?
He's still the busiest man in tennis.
So many jobs. So many jobs.
Well, in addition to his many hats that he's not really wearing right now because he's had this to deal with, he has all these court cases. He's caught all these cases, and so he really is that busy.
Stop. That is a mess and a half.
I am not bothered. But it's clear. So it's tweeted without comment, and then it's retweeted without comment, right? There's no editorializing from Justin with sharing this story. And so clearly you go and you read it because obviously there's something in it that he wants us to hear, right? He's telling us, I'm not saying that I'm a per... I'm not saying that I'm perfect or that I shouldn't have handled that night differently. I should have. I would give anything to undo it. I'd give every dollar that I have to take that 5 minutes back. But I didn't do what he said, and my whole life and my whole career and my relationship with my son should not be ended because of it. He's still maintaining that what was presented in court, the evidence that made the judge unequivocal in finding guilt with Gimelstob, was not the case, right? He's still maintaining that. We were not there. We don't know for sure. There's that caveat.
That was from an interview in March, according to the story. So this isn't new information, but it was published by the New York Times today. The judge was clear. First of all, the judge admonished Gimelstob for his behavior in court, saying that he needed to control himself during the victim impact statements. But it was also clear that if you attempt to proclaim your innocence in public, you will be back in court, and that the deal is in jeopardy at that point. It's just interesting to me why you wouldn't just be quiet after all this. Because to me, like, you've dodged a bullet, right? You weren't convicted of a felony. You pleaded no contest. You didn't have to plead guilty. Like, you did not admit guilt. You said to the court, punish me as you see fit. That's exactly what no contest means.
Isn't this one of the greatest examples of what white privilege is? That not only do you escape a criminal judgment, you don't have to do jail time. There's video evidence of you beating this person, regardless.
We haven't seen.
Regardless of how you say it happened. You admit in this article that, yeah, I let my son go away, and then I came back and I beat this dude up. Like, that's what you say.
Yeah.
And there's video evidence of it. But
he said it was more like a fight rather than an attack.
But you still feel entitled to all these positions in your career.
Why should he not feel entitled when these organizations are setting the table for his return? That's what these statements mean.
It makes me wonder, what does he have on these people? Why is he so essential to all these people?
Right.
The ATP Players Council, those guys are clearly basic.
No, the motivation is clear. They feel that Gimelstob is working in their financial interests. And that's clear.
I find that motivation to be basic. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but it's recognizable. It even makes sense, rationally. You don't have to think that it's good, that it's ethical, but it makes rational sense.
It only makes rational sense based on how we know straight white men to operate in life and the privilege that they assume in society.
You don't have to think it's good. I don't think it is. I don't think it shows a lot of integrity.
I just take issue with the makes sense thing. Like, I'm not at that point.
Well, it makes sense to them. What I'm more interested in, which is a little more amorphous, is this fear among people who are quite powerful in tennis to say anything negative. Some of them are gagged informally by their chosen professions.
I imagine that Martina Navratilova is gagged by Tennis Channel at this point.
Right, but like at the same time, does Martina need Tennis Channel? Like, she's Martina Navratilova. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When has she not felt comfortable saying what she feels? Mm-hmm. Like, there is something specific about this situation that makes people who are normally outspoken and normally principled either scared to talk or unwilling to talk. And to me, that's the most interesting part of this case. It's not the players, because their motivations are obvious. It's what goes on that you can't see. It's similar to, as we said in a previous episode, the Me Too movement across all industries. People in positions of power are not speaking up because they're afraid. That's what allows these things to fester, right? So what about Gimelstob makes people afraid to speak out?
I'm looking to hold everybody accountable. Mm. I'm not looking to excuse the players because it makes sense to them. I want to make that clear.
Well, I'm not excusing.
And that's what I mean by saying basic. I feel like basic might not be the best. It might be too colloquial for the issue at hand, right?
Okay.
But them taking that position is part and parcel of why the ATP is floundering and drowning in all these issues that while they might not think it to be a problem now because they have the big bright stars, it could drown them in another couple years in this era, right? Like, what these men do not look past their self-interest to allow in anything else that affects other people, right? We are looking for a tennis community writ large, specifically the ATP, that is more inclusive, that brings in people rather than just insulates to protect a chosen few self-interest, because it's still not clear that these guys are fighting for the players ranked below the top 100. So let's not give them that benefit of the doubt that is too expansive in my mind.
Although, I think if you asked a lot of the players, you may not like their answer.
I absolutely believe that. And to your point, does Martina Navratilova believe that she will not be able to make bread elsewhere? Like, it's a matter of comfort when it boils down to it, right? We don't know her, clearly. We don't know Martina. We don't have her on the speed dial. But what are we to infer at this point? Why is it that given that you have something to say about everything on Twitter, about every imaginable subject, that if something that you deem untenable within your personal life, that should line up with what you've given to us publicly, we should expect that Martina should come down on this side of the fence based on how she presents herself publicly, that you are held captive because of your relationship with Tennis Channel. There are any number of other tennis outlets for you to be commentating on, for you to make money from. You are Martina Navratilova. You are a seminal figure in tennis history. And not only have you done that on the court, you're one of the few who is able to offer cutting, witty, insightful stuff on air. So you have a resume. What is it about this Justin Gimelstob situation that renders you mute? Is it just self-preservation, or is there something more with everybody involved that has Justin Gimelstob able to still fester and exist in spite of this and have so many people silent? That's what I want to know, because that's where I was going with the whole business of him being not that great of a tennis commentator, because he's not essential as a tennis commentator. He's telling us in this article that he is essential as a member of the Players Council.
Yeah, you get the sense that behind the scenes in the governance structure, he actually is essential.
He says, the article says, he has a theory on why he has maintained his position at the ATP despite legal problems. Justin says, this sounds horrible, but I'm very good at what I do. And that upsets people in our structure. The players know how good I am, especially in terms of improving prize money for them, and that pisses off the tournaments. It annoys them that, even in a compromised state, I've been able to outwit, outmaneuver, outstrategize, and outmobilize them.
I have no problem saying that he is probably very good at what he does. He's probably very intelligent. It's just like the amount of bullshit that you are willing to tolerate, like the baggage that comes with. Is it fine for you? If so, I guess you vote yes on May 14th.
Something that's also clear from this article that he's retweeting is that he still sees himself as a viable option for CEO of the ATP. He's asked, what if you learn that you've become more of a liability to tennis than an asset? And he says, it would fall under the bucket of consequences and being a man and taking responsibility for it. I want the same for the council, for the greater good. But I wouldn't be the first person who's had a major issue. Extenuating circumstances and ascended to tremendous positions of responsibility, power, and leadership. I could turn it around, and I think that would be one of my greatest, most proud achievements. That's how that article ends.
Man.
This is a day after this shit show has come out. And this is the first that we hear from Justin Gimelstob. An article ended with him saying, yeah, I've had my shit, but I can turn it around. And I still think it would be a good thing. I'm still that person for the job.
I'm that bitch. So to be clear, he did not necessarily say that today. Right, but it's been published today.
He has tweeted it today at this very specific time. So I take it to mean it's timely.
Okay.
That's how I take it.
I mean, he still obviously agrees with that.
Obviously. But this is the first time we've really heard specific confirmation of what his intent is. Mm. We've always speculated that whether it was the Players' Council, what they wanted for Gimelstob with respect to replacing Kermode, or what his intentions were, we were always fearful and suspicious. Now we know. Pospisil has doubled down, and now we get this endorsement of himself from Gimelstob today.
Self-endorsement.
It's a self-endorsement. Yeah. That closing paragraph, and then the previous one that I stated where he says, this is going to piss people off, but I'm that good at what I do. I outwit, I outmaneuver. The queen wishes she could do what I do. Like, my longevity to be able to, like, maneuver and manipulate outmatches everybody.
Yes. So he's Littlefinger.
Yeah. I'm just saying, cards are on the table now. We know where we're getting a clearer picture of where everybody stands.
I want everyone to be clear and open.
What I'm looking...
Vashek was very clear about what he plans to vote for.
Yeah.
John Isner, I mean, that's ridiculous. There's no way he should be allowed to vote on this, but he will. In the future, good luck getting a press credential for any ATP tournament, because this dude's going to be CEO.
Listen,
I guess we played ourselves.
That's not a problem. There are a lot of folks who had a lot to say pushing back against the vigilantism of this Justin Gimelstob situation.
You know, I do, topic for another day, because we're going long. I take issue with vigilantism being used negatively. Haven't you ever seen a superhero movie? Like, vigilantes are the people creating, like, restorative justice when the status quo isn't doing it. They're the good guys.
We're in a different era.
Okay.
We're in a different time and place. So these folks were out here saying, well, hold up, wait a minute, let's wait and see. You're rushing to judgment, you're assassinating this man's character, you're ruining his career, you're killing him like Doug Adler, you're ruining him like Neil Harmon. Like, what has he done? Well, now we know. Now we know. So I want to hear from you as well. I don't want a deletion of tweets from what you said back then. I don't want silence, as if you are bracing for a nuclear war, hunkered down in a tennis Twitter bunker. I don't want that. I want honesty. The same honesty that you
demanded
from us.
Of everyone else.
Because collectively.
We don't have to say alleged anymore.
No.
We did. We were careful.
That's what no contest does.
But there was a conviction.
He can no longer claim innocence. The judge directed that. So what I want to know now is, are you willing to have an honest discussion about that? Demand the same honesty of yourselves that you accused us of not giving Justin Gimelstob. Can we move toward a more perfect union of this discourse? And that is full of the tongue and the cheek when I say that.
Were you educated in the United States?
I've been with you for far too long. Like, this is a whole mess. It'll continue to be messy. The tea leaves are there for us to read that Gimelstob is not going away. The ATP Council is not distancing itself from him. We will find out in Rome, apparently. That's when he'll be up for re-election. Yeah. We'll actually be in Rome at that time. Not on site. Well, on site, but not in press. Mm-hmm. But we'll be there. And
this kills my vibe, I'm really going to be upset.
It'll be the end of our trip. It'll be fine.
We'll be ready to go home anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And we know how Tennis Channel feels. So now that all the cards are out on the table, let's see where they lay. Just be warned that you are now aligning yourself with something that at this point is irreversible.
In other news, Lizzo played 2 consecutive weekends at Coachella, and they fucked up her audio 2 consecutive weekends.
And the second time, she was like, you're not gonna stunt on my vibe. You're just not gonna do
that. So she did the music and the choreo without audio.
Mm-hmm.
A cappella.
And then brought out her flute.
She said, this is why I got my music major.
It's gonna be tricky for us with recording for the next little bit. We hope to have an episode out next week before we leave. And then also have one pre-recorded to release while we're away. And that pre-recorded episode, we're thinking, is going to be a mailbag episode. So please send us anything you've wanted to ask us ever. We'll answer anything.
Well, no, we won't.
I mean, we won't answer not like really anything. Rude shit. Like, you know, like the trollish stuff, we won't, probably won't do that.
But send us, also like send us tea.
Tea?
Yeah, if you know something. Or if you have a story you'd like us to tell on your behalf, we'll do it.
To at least tennis related.
Well, I mean, if it's like Beyonce related, we'll do that too.
Oh my God. Send us your mailbag questions to thebodyserve@gmail.com, to tennis_John on Twitter. That's my handle.
Or me at ElliotJMR. Elliot is not my name.
It is not.
By the way. So if you're going to call me out, what's good, Miley?
Your name is James. And as you said,
it is
different from your name. Your Twitter handle is at ElliotJMR.
Mm-hmm. Elliot. It's bare consonants, full of L's, full of T's.
Exactly. On that note, thanks for listening. Till next time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.